same since I called in, and they took down my pledge and they took down my name at WEF
Hello, good evening. You're listening to Where We Are At here on WEFT 90.1 FM Radio. This is a pre-recorded show. The date is Monday, October 5th, 2020. Just to let you know, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. This is a statement that Alan Max Axelrod, a Democratic Socialist of America, DSA, and activist here in Champaign, wanted me to read about the no Ameren shutoffs. Governor J.B. Pritzker probably lied over the weekend about utility shutoffs in public discourse. Further, the following is a statement from an anonymous Ameren employee. Ameren Illinois has instructed employees, in contradiction of the Illinois Commerce Commission press release on their agreement, to shut off past due accounts based on whether a household had received LIHEAP in the last 12 months. However, LIHEAP's eligibility in Illinois is based off of monthly income. Anyone who is not earning above 200% of the federal poverty line in the last 30 days is eligible. This is the basis of the instruction from the ICC that, quote, no documentation or written proof is necessary, but you must make the phone call and verbalize your difficulty, end quote. Despite this action being done by a resident in Alton, 72 hours into the six-month agreement, Ameren Illinois shut off their power. Ameren Illinois appears to be doing this to aggressively push for deferred payment agreements with hard and real consequences. This restrictive standard is hugely problematic because, especially during pandemic, there's customers calling into Ameren reporting that they can't be seen or talked to for months because of how overwhelmed are under-supported social services are. Yet again, we see the consequences of Governor J.B. Pritzker not enacting a mandatory utility shutoffs moratorium. According to one anonymous Ameren employee, Ameren is not only continuing to do well as they were in their quarter to 2020 earnings call, but also discouraging employees from asking callers if they are experiencing financial hardship. Though that was a statement that Alan Max Axelrod wanted me to give. Thank you, Alan, for writing that and sending that. Here are some public service announcements. On November 23rd, 2012, WEFT Champaign was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, to serve the public interest as a public trustee until December 1st of 2020. WEFT's current license will expire on that date, December 1st, 2020. We have filed an application for license renewal with the FCC. A copy of this application is available for inspection at www.fcc.gov. WEF's application contains information concerning the station's performance over the last eight years. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and or whether the station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the FCC by November 1st, 2020. I believe November 1st, that's a Sunday, so we got a couple of months, so just letting you know. Further information concerning the FCC's broadcast license renewal process is available at 113 North Market Street, so 113 North Market Street, Champaign, Illinois, or may be obtained from the FCC in Washington, D.C. You can go to the website www.fcc.gov. Again, www.fcc.gov. For over 150 years, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign has fostered educational experiences and pioneered innovations with one very clear and simple goal: to change the world for the better. No matter where you are, the University of Illinois is providing information on their plans to maximize the health and safety of their students, faculty, staff, and university community during the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, if you are interested, you can or are able to go to the website https://covid19.illinois.edu. So if you just type in the URL covid19.illinois.edu and press enter, it should take you to the website. Thank you very much. And a reminder, since the election is coming up, which will be on November 3rd, you can go to the Champaign County Clerk website, which is Champaign County Clerk, all one word, champaigncountyclerk.com. You can go to elections where you can look up your voter information. They also give you a phone number, which is 217-384-3720. Again, that phone number for the Champaign County Clerk Office, 217-384-3720, where you can verify your information about your voter information to look up, essentially where your voting, your polling place will be, where you will vote. And you can also look up vital records. And if you would like to, remember, to be able to register to vote, you have to be an American citizen. You have to be 18 years of age or older. You could also, register to vote, update your registration. You can call the elections divisions. That phone number is 217-384-3724. Again, that phone number is 217-384-3724. You could also request records such as birth, death, and or marriage certificates, if marriage licenses, DBAs, notaries, or other licenses. You can also email the Champaign County Clerk at mail@champaigncountyclerk.com. Again, mail@champaigncountyclerk, all one word, .com. You can also call 217-384-3720. Again, 217-384-3720. And that number is to make an appointment. And yes, and you can also request your vote by mail ballot by going to the website champaigncountyclerk.com. again, champaigncountyclerk.com. given what's happening with the COVID-19 epidemic, you might want to do that, or just letting you know that you'll have the option to do that. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And that concludes this edition of Where We're At. My name is Ben Theobald. This is WEFT 90.1 FM radio. This is an interview with Robert Garcia. He is an activist. He was at the protest in Louisville that followed after the jury decision on Breonna Taylor. I am talking with Robert Garcia. Who, would you call yourself an organizer, Robert?
Sure.
For those who don't know, the jury in the Breonna Taylor case ruled essentially that police officers that were involved in the shooting, only one of three officers that were involved on were charged with, I believe it wasn't exactly felony charges. It was first degree wanton endangerment. So Essentially, no officer was charged in the killing of Breonna Taylor. And I believe he's not going to do much time. And I believe he will get parole. So I guess, Garcia, what was your reaction to the decision that the jury made?
I think my first reaction was really disappointment, but not surprise. We had a clue leading up to the non-indictment announcement from the grand jury, because the city and authorities, those that were very close to it and were trying to seal the details and not release transcripts and try to hide information, they seemed to know that this was coming, and they gave off some clues because they started implementing curfews and deploying National Guard, and they started doing things to prepare. So the community had an indication that it wasn't going to be a just response. It's kind of hard to put into words, you know, the reaction. My first thoughts were, okay, I'm not surprised. And then my second thought was, I was thinking about her family. I was thinking about Breonna Taylor's family. And, you know, I try to, you know, it's hard to imagine what it must be like to have to deal with the horror of what happened to her that night, and then to have them stick with this fight for so long, demanding justice, organizing with community organizers and with the community, and even with city leaders. And all of that effort, all of that fight, just to be told, nah, we're not going to give your family member justice. So it was very, that was hard to try to, to try to process, you know, because we're, it's easy for us to be detached from it, but yeah, that was my next thought was, and I can't imagine what it's like if it was my family member, how pissed off, how enraged I would be. And so I tried to imagine what it must, how difficult it must be for them trying to process the injustice that they were dealt.
And you went all the way down to Louisville. What followed after were protests for in Louisville, also all around the country, in New York, Los Angeles, and I believe Chicago, but even here in Champaign. But you went all the way down to Louisville to partake in the protests. Can I ask you, why did you feel the need to travel all the way down to Louisville?
Sure. I mean, I wanted to stand in solidarity with the people of Louisville, with Breonna Taylor's family. And for me personally, and I can't speak for others, but for me personally, I was angry. I didn't feel comfortable just sitting at home and not being a part of the response. I was angry at the lack of justice, but I was also really concerned about people not responding appropriately, meaning they sit at home, they watch the news, they get angry, they post on social media, and they do nothing. And my concern is if people don't respond in that city, if they don't take to the streets, then these folks in authority think that they can keep getting away with this. And that's the problem we have right now. We are allowing this to happen again and again and again. And so for me, the reason I went down, Ben, is because I didn't want to look back one day and think, man, I really wish I had done something. I really wish I had resisted this, you know, fascist creep in our country, where this creep of fascism continues to slowly rise and it just continues to happen and we just allow it. I feel like there should be this massive movement of people responding and fighting back in order to show folks in authority that we're not just going to sit idly by and accept this. So for me, any little thing I can do as one more person in that solidarity, in that movement, in that response, I think is, you know, the least I can do. And that's why I was there. I don't want to look back one day and think, yeah, I sat by and I posted on social media and that was enough. It's not enough. So I wanted to be a part of that, of that people movement, so that these folks in authority understand that they can take their curfew and their fascist rules and their military occupation and they can shove it. The people are not going to have it. And I feel like we need a lot more of that.
I believe the protest started that Wednesday, last Wednesday.
Yep.
And were you there that from Wednesday?
No, we got there Thursday night. There were a couple of us that went down from Central Illinois, from Bloomington Normal. So we were there for two nights, Thursday night and Friday night. So Wednesday night is when the announcement came that there was only going to be this one charge for wanton endangerment for the bullets that missed. No concern for the bullets that murdered her, but they were concerned about the bullets that missed. That was the only charge that stuck, which is disgusting. So that first night, there were two officers that were shot and went to the hospital. And so the night we got there was the night right after that, which is why the police response on the night we arrived was so hostile and aggressive.
It really started to escalate. The police were really
arrived was the night that the police decided to just, you know, they were pissed because the night before two officers had been shot. So we come in the night right after when the police have spent 24 hours planning and plotting and in anger and wanting to get revenge for the two officers that have been shot the night before. So we show up and we walk into this most disgusting, most hostile, most aggressive environment that I've ever experienced with police. And, you know, I've dealt with Chicago PD, you know, being aggressive and kettling us, but nothing prepared me for Louisville Metro PD. They were just... they were there wanting to hurt people, wanting to arrest as many people as they could. I mean, on that first night, they arrested 127 people. They arrested, at least more than two dozen on that second night. I don't know how many arrested on the third night or fourth night. I lost count after that. But we're talking about hundreds of people just getting rounded up. People that had not done anything wrong, weren't looting or rioting, weren't responsible for the shootings of those two officers. This was just a police force of angry people wanting to hurt the public and blame anyone. And they were blaming, you know, protesters, peaceful protesters. And so they kept pushing this ridiculous narrative in the media, led by their police chief there, that it was our fault for being associated with criminals, murderers, and looters and rioters. And so it was difficult. I remember sitting there the morning after. So the night we got there, we were, you know, There was a lot of arrests. People were pepper sprayed. People were beat. They were beaten and arrested and hauled away. They would literally just snatch them up, pull them behind the police line so we couldn't see. And they would surround them with a circle of police so that you couldn't see, you know, when somebody, they didn't want us to record when they were beating somebody. So they were very, very organized about circling them, the police that were doing the beating and arresting. And then in front of that was the police line with the sticks ready to hit you. If you tried to get close and record. So it was really, really hard to get a lot of this stuff on camera for live streaming, for documentation. And that's what they wanted. They wanted to make sure that that footage wasn't going to be seen. But I can tell you, I saw it happen right before my eyes. And it was hard to watch because these were people that were just there peacefully demonstrating. They weren't going after looters or rioters. They were going after folks that were in our group, you know, the ones that were marching. And they were going after folks on the perimeter. They were targeting stragglers, people that were just trying to leave, the people that said, okay, I can't walk anymore, I'm gonna leave the march. Those were the folks that I saw get arrested. And if they tried to, like, you know, say, hey, I'm not doing anything, what's going on? They would immediately just get physically violent with them, pepper spray them, whatever they wanted. It was a gross abuse of power and authority over and over. And you just could see, you know, it was like rage, and it was unbridled, unchecked power. And they were just going to take anybody they could take.
It got to a point where you and a number of protesters, demonstrators were essentially taking sanctuary, held up in a church.
Yep.
And what was that situation like? Because you were there for quite a few hours at least, right?
Yeah, we were there for over 2 hours. There was a standoff. We were basically trapped by police. They told us there was a curfew at 9 p.m. And if I'm being honest, we didn't have any intention of honoring that curfew. But it didn't matter even if we had intended to honor the curfew, because before 9 p.m., they started already arresting people. And they admitted it. And we had it on video, like, okay, it's not 9 p.m. yet. Why are they already arresting stragglers and taking people in? And so I'll get back to that in a minute with the police chief's press conference the following day. But to answer your question, yeah, we ended up being kettled and boxed in on all sides by police. And it wasn't just like, you know, oh, two police cars forming a blockade and three or four or five cops. I'm talking like an army, like a small army of police that went like blocks deep. It was insane. I've never, ever, ever seen so many police like that together. It looked like an army. And so there was really nothing you could do. You couldn't move against them. It, you know, it was impossible. So we were kettled and boxed and forced. They were really the ones controlling the route. And so even before the curfew, when people tried to go home to beat the curfew, they started arresting people. And we could not get back to our cars before the curfew. The cars were parked at Jefferson Square downtown. We had the march. They had the LMPD had controlled the route. They were, forcing us where they wanted us to go and weren't letting us go follow our route that we had planned. They weren't letting us go back to Jefferson Square to get back to the vehicles. So we ended up at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Louisville. And that was private property. The ministers there were very welcoming and helpful. But it made no sense. Like we couldn't get an answer as to why they were surrounding us at a church. It was just the most bizarre experience. I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone. Like here we are, just peaceful public citizens, and we're surrounded by this massive army of police in full riot gear. With water, they brought out water cannons, and they were pepper spraying people. And anyone who stepped off church property saying, hey, I'm going to leave, I'm going to go home, I have to go. There were people who legitimately needed to leave. Like, hey, I've got my kids waiting at home. I got to go. I can't, you know, I got a babysitter. Literally just people begging, like, please let me go. And they were pepper sprayed and arrested. And I was like, what on earth is happening? Not a single person was allowed to leave. We were 100% trapped for over 2 hours. It was the most insane thing. I couldn't understand how that could be happening in America. I'm still in shock, I think, I still can't process it. You know, here I am a few days later and I'm still not able to shake it. Like, I don't understand how that even happens in this country. and it's very defeating.
Charles Booker, who ran for Senate, what is currently Mitch McConnell's Senate position, he tweeted that, imagine that police officers are surrounding a church waiting for anyone to step off the property so they can arrest them for breaking curfew. Now imagine the ministers working to get everyone inside the sanctuary to keep them safe. This is a reality in my city right now. Because I remember seeing that, and then I saw that you were there in Louisville and talking about that, how you were in a church, and I was just kind of like, oh my, one, I was very concerned for your safety, Robert, but I'm glad you're okay.
Thank you. But, I mean, yeah. I was concerned for my safety because I wanted to leave. I was one of the people that desperately wanted to leave, yeah. But I also witnessed what I witnessed and knew I can't leave. Like, I'm going to get beat if I move, you know? So there was nowhere to go. And I just have never been in any situation like that ever with police. So it was rough to process. I'm an emotional, sensitive person by nature. I admit that freely. So for me, it was just not a fun experience. And I'm really glad that Cory Booker, the tweet that you just referenced, it was frustrating because while this was happening, we're live streaming and we're seeing comments from people. And it was very, very frustrating to be in the situation where we're there firsthand. We know we're trapped. We see our fellow comrades getting pepper sprayed, beat, handcuffed, and dragged away. So that was difficult. And then you see these comments from people online while it's happening, you know, just saying, oh, you should, you know, you deserve it. You're violating curfew. Why don't you go home? It's after 9. And, you know, and I'm like, even if, you know, and I admit freely, look, I didn't intend to honor the curfew. I'm just being truthful, okay? But even if I had, and even when I wanted to go home, I couldn't, you know? Even when I was exhausted and my feet hurt, I was done. This was hours and hours in. I was so exhausted. I just wanted to go home. They weren't letting us. And so it was so frustrating to be in that situation and then to have to see this stupid online debate and while it was happening in real time, of people just arguing, well, that's stupid. You can just leave. Like, what's the problem? Like, no one can leave. Like, they're hurting people. Like, I'm not going to be stupid enough and walk out there and be the next guy to get beat. Like, why would I do that? So it was frustrating. And we didn't know how long the standoff was going to last. They kept telling us, well, you'll have to stay here all night. We're not going anywhere till 6:30 a.m. And so that's what they were telling us. And anyways, there was a lot of misinformation they kept throwing at us. But I was grateful that Cory Booker and others spoke about it and were trying to help document the truth as to what was happening. And the tone of his tweet was right on. It was like bizarro world. I couldn't understand, like, what on earth is happening? Like, we kept asking, like, why are you doing this? Like, why don't you want us to go home? You're telling us to go home. We're trying to comply. What's the problem? Like, we're in agreement. We want to go home. Let us go home now. And they wouldn't. So I was like, okay. So if we do what you tell us, you're going to beat us and arrest us. Oh yeah. And that's the answer we got. And that's exactly what they did over and over.
But they did eventually did one of the police officers or members of the police come in and say, okay, we're going to just let you all go?
Well, they did and they didn't. It was eventually, yes. So there were three instances. The first one was they were in contact with the organizers. There were 5 organizers there that night, and as well as hosts at the church, the ministers that were there trying to help us stay safe. And they were helping to try to negotiate our release from, you know, the situation where we're trapped by police. So they were in contact with LMPD. And the first instance, they told us in this particular corner, we're going to make way. So we were boxed in all around, choppers both flying above. But they told us in this corner right here, if you come to this corner, we're going to make way when you come, and we're going to let you out if you come down this corner. 10 minutes, let your people know. So they come out, they announce it on the PA system, okay, everything's okay, everything's resolved, you guys, standoff's over, police have agreed, we've worked out a solution, they're going to let you go. In 10 minutes, if you're ready to go, just go right this corner. That's where they're going to let you go out. So in 10 minutes time, people went to that corner and they were pepper sprayed and handcuffed and taken away. Not a single one was allowed to leave. And that just really, you know, that was hard to process because we were like, okay, that really just reinforced that we were trapped and now we were like, I was angry. I'm like, okay, now they're just flat out lying because they want to do this. They want to get their revenge and payback for the night before where two officers were shot. They wanted to hurt people. They wanted to arrest people, and that became clear. And they were flat out lying to ministers and to organizers that were trying to negotiate compliance with their own commands. And they wouldn't honor their own commands. They wouldn't honor their own curfew and let people go home. They were, so that was disturbing to see that. So of course, after you see people getting arrested and pepper sprayed, no one else wanted to go. We're like, okay, they didn't make way, they didn't recede, so nobody else would go. Then the second instance was they came back and said, okay, you know, we'll let you go, just go in a big group, and we're going to marshal you and kettle you back to Jefferson Square. We're not gonna let you just go on your own. We're gonna, the whole group has to go together, and we're gonna surround the group, and we're gonna force you to Jefferson Square where you gotta get in your cars and go home. And so they told us that they would do that. So we started to line up. All the media, and of course the media immediately said, like, you could hear people talking, like, so much media, they're like, it's not gonna happen, it's not gonna happen. They're gonna do something bad to them, watch. And so all the media like ran to the front, ready to like capture everything. And sure enough, the police never receded. But thankfully by then, the people that were there had smartened up, and they're not gonna let us go. Like, this, you just saw what happened to the folks that tried. So we lined up, we watched, we said, hey, we're ready, and they never moved, they didn't move. So if we had approached them, it was going to be the same outcome. They weren't making way. Twice they promised, we're going to make way, we're going to give you pass, we're going to do it right here, you got to come to this, you know. And both times it was a flat out lie. They didn't. So at that point we were like, we're just going to stay here all night, and they're supposed to leave at 6:30 a.m. when the curfew is lifted, and that's what we'll do. So that was our plan. And then finally, for some reason, after a 2-hour standoff, after a lot of pressure from some, you know, the media coverage, I think, was helpful. Having folks like Cory Booker talk about it publicly, I think, was helpful. I think after some pressure, they realized, okay, people know what's happening here. We're going to have to let them go. We got all these people trapped, and what are we going to do? You know? So finally, after a little over 2 hours, and a bunch of lies, they just all receded at once. All of them just pulled back, disappeared. It was calm and peace after that. We were able to finally leave.
Yeah. Oh, just sorry. It's Charles Booker, Cory Booker.
Oh, sorry.
You're right.
My apologies.
No.
Thank you.
It's spelled the same. It's the same name, but I guess. And so, what was kind of your reaction to when they finally just said, you know, hey, we're gonna let you go? Where, you know, I guess you were relieved, and I imagine kind of, because that must have been a very tense, stressful, scary situation.
Yeah, you know, folks were, it was rough just trying to figure out, like, there was so much doubt at that point. You deal with different police departments in different cities. But at that point, I was fearful. I lost all trust. Like, I had zero trust. It's not like dealing with, you know, Bloomington PD. It's not like dealing with, you know, police in Decatur or Springfield or Peoria or even in Chicago, where they're nasty and rough and they do some of the same stuff. This was worse. So I had just lost all trust. I had zero faith. And the whole time we were, you know, walking back, I was still fearful. I felt like, you know, like, I literally was afraid I was going to get snatched up. And I'm like, I can't believe, like, this is my reality right now. I was just constantly looking around, trying to be aware of my surroundings and preparing myself, like, how can I evade? I don't want to get arrested. That was my big fear. I really did not want to get arrested. You know, go figure. Most people don't. So that was it. I was just really concerned about, okay, how can I get back without getting arrested? And having no trust and faith. But thankfully, yeah, they left us alone after that, and we were able to get back.
And how many people were you said you came with the group that traveled from Bloomington?
There was just two of us that came, rode down together from Bloomington Normal. So there's two of us. There were a lot of other people there that were not locals. We met people there from Oregon, from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of people from Indiana, because it's right on the state border. But there were a lot of folks that had showed up to show solidarity. A lot of folks like us who had come as volunteers, bringing medical supplies and whatever we could do to help.
And I know you were in Decatur today, also doing more protests, and you were in Bloomington. So you've been still continuing your
Your
protest. After what happened in Louisville, why do you feel the need to kind? I mean, I think most people would understand if you wanted to take maybe a little break but you keep going. So why do you keep going?
I have this. I think there's this bigger picture. Yes, there's the Black Lives Matter movement, right? That's first and foremost, that's where the greatest harm is. And that's where our strongest primary focus has to be. That's paramount. But there is a lot more to it. There is, in my opinion, it's just the rise of fascism in America. It's what Trump and this rigged system that we call politics, democracy, et cetera, has given us. And so police brutality is a part of that. ICE and the abuse of immigrants is also a part of that. The erosion, the slow, steady, crawling erosion of our rights and liberties is a part of that. The idea that I have to ask the government for permission to protest them, those kinds of things, you know, these constant rules at the city level, and it's local municipality, state and federal, it's just this constant erosion of our rights and liberties. For me, I keep going because I feel like stuff we learned about in history courses as children and in college that they tell us happens in foreign countries and, you know, these horror stories we hear, I feel like we're seeing the beginnings of that here. Like, we already have it here. Fascism is already here. So for me, regardless of what community it is, when I see good people who get it, who understand that the harm is real and it's already here and are trying to sound that alarm, I feel a sense of urgency. I share their sense of urgency, and I want to be there to support them in any way I can. But mostly because I don't believe that the electoral response, the traditional electoral response, is going to work when you're dealing with a fascist president like Donald Trump. I am convinced that he is a full-on fascist. He doesn't care how people vote. You got all these people saying, hey, the answer is vote, and that's it. Same old tired response. Well, you just got to vote. You got to vote. They don't understand that this is a fascist monster who has already told us in advance he doesn't care how you vote. He doesn't want to leave. And if people think that we're just supposed to sit around and let this happen, they don't believe that it's real. They're in denial that it's happening in their own country. So for me, I'm full on like fearful of this. I feel like it's real, it's here, it's been here. And it wasn't like an overnight, you know, flip of the switch, it was dark and light. It was a slow, steady crawl. And so I think too many people have just ignored it, but it's here. And so that's why I keep showing up, because I feel like we have to get more people into the movement. We have to get more people to come join us in the streets. We have seen historical examples. We saw in Puerto Rico, we saw in South Korea, we saw in Hong Kong. And there, you know, we've seen parts of the world where you can have peaceful, nonviolent demonstrations to overthrow some authoritarian or fascist or dictator type of rule over the people. But they were only effective when they had mass, when they had numbers, people power. And then the government had no choice. You can't just ignore. They can ignore and wait us out when it's 5 people, 500 people, 2,000 people, right? But when you have this mass, people showing up in mass saying, hey, we're not going to go to work. We're going to shut down the systems. There are ways that we could peacefully force change to our benefit if people decide to band together and do it. And in America, we have this constant, you know, propaganda machine, corporate-owned media, et cetera, which is why I'm glad we have people like you, Ben, truth tellers, because there's not a lot in the media. And so we just have folks that are fed, you know, all this fear-mongering and propaganda in support of the current system. And so it's hard. So we have to keep showing up. We have to keep trying to win over people and bring them into the movement. I don't believe that Donald Trump gives a damn how people vote. He doesn't care. You could vote, not vote. He doesn't care. He's not going anywhere until we, the people, force him out.
And in terms of, and I think this is something we, I feel like with, you know, these kind of protests, these kind of rallies, the way our news cycle works, you hear about, you know, granted, this is because the case, you know, this started, I believe this started back around April, the whole, the, or, well, the news about her death, about the police, that was around April. I mean, people were inside with COVID, and so it was kind of like a, you know, that is when this really all started, and then it kind of, these rallies, marches spun up again with what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and, you know, that's only a few hours from here, and I guess when I'm always in kind of agitated or very, makes me kind of so angry with the media is that, you know, it's one of those, you see it in the headlines for maybe a few days, then it goes away. Even though the rallies, even though the marches, the protests are still happening, but the news, they're not covering it. Even like, because, you know, I know in Portland, there were protests happening. Unfortunately, it's really, really escalated there. And, you know, there with the police and the that there's this group called the Proud Boys. That's very hateful. I guess we would say most likely filled with white supremacists, but they're just running rampant. They're, and the police aren't doing anything about them. They're just, it's just absolutely insane. Sorry, I kind of went out there, but with the way the news cycle works, I'm always a bit annoyed. It seems like the news, our attention, you know, I guess it kind of caters to the average, maybe the average person's attention span. You know, we obviously live in, I guess, this iPhone generation where you kind of look at your phone, you look at something for a little bit, and then you click on or swipe to the next thing. And that's kind of how our news usually caters. Obviously, we're coming to an election here, so. I don't know, the way I'm seeing this, it's like this is still going to be happening even after the election, and, you know, obviously we're all kind of stressing and dreading how the election is going to go, because I think I think we're not going to know the results of the election, and that could really also get mixed in with this too, with these protests and these rallies. And so I don't know what's been kind of your reaction to, since this all started in April, how you've seen these protests, these rallies?
Yeah. I know in Louisville in particular, it was around May when the numbers really began to surge. And we saw what happened. Of course, you know, they had Breonna Taylor. There were actually other victims as well, and other stories that are not getting enough coverage because Louisville Metro PD didn't just hurt Breonna Taylor. They hurt a lot of other people too. But again, they're not getting adequate coverage. And then we had, you know, George Floyd. And so all of this came together. What's disappointing to me is that the numbers ebb and flow. There was a moment after George Floyd's death where it was popular to protest. It was, you know, social media clout. It was trendy. And so people came out, there were thousands, that's great, but they just protest, take their pictures, post on social media, and then they go home. They didn't do anything. I feel like a lot of organizers didn't do a good job of trying to win those people over into the movement. We didn't, like, you know, get their information and engage them in calls to action, to actually have city council folks feel the pressure and the heat to actually effectuate change. I mean, that's the goal. If you want to fight police brutality, you know, you have to defund police, you have to change those policies. That happens in each municipality at the city council level. Your alderman, alderperson, your city council person, depending on if you have aldermanic system or not, those folks are the ones that have the power to decide what your police force looks like, what restrictions and rules they place on them to make sure that they're keeping the public safe. It's not rocket science. We know the answer. We know the solution. It's right there in front of us. But if we just protest and then we go home and we don't focus on city council or elected officials, we're not getting any change. There were a few communities that got it, that stormed their city council meetings, took them over and said, listen, we're not negotiating. We're done with this. This is the right thing to do. We demand it. You need to do it. But most communities, the organizers didn't do a good job of pivoting protesters to city council change. Most communities, unfortunately. And so you have all these people showing up ready to join your movement. And, you know, they just protest when it's trendy and then that's it. We don't hear from them. So the numbers really dwindled. And then there would, you know, there'd be another case, another video. We saw what happened in Kenosha and then boom, the numbers climb again. People come back out. And it's the exact same. It's very frustrating because it's the same pattern again. Do that for a few days and then the numbers dwindle again and they're back to their regular lives. Okay, we're mad. We let people know we don't like it. And then they go back. But they're not doing the work of changing the system that allows this to continue over and over and over. So, you know, you ask me why I keep showing up, because I do feel like it's going to be up to, you know, those folks that are sick and tired and frustrated to keep showing up and to keep trying to spread this message and pivot to city council folks. And if we can't force the current city council people, the ones that have those seats now, to do the right thing, then the next step is to vote them out. We have to get progressive folks to run for office, regular everyday people, to have the courage to step up and run. And we have to rally behind them and win those seats so that we have people there who will listen to the people and do the right thing to properly police and protect our communities. It's frustrating to see that pattern over and over and over again. But protests, they add a little bit of value, but they're not the change that we need. They don't bring the change that we need. The work happens after the protest. The change happens after the protest. Protests are good. I mean, they're going to add a little bit of awareness. People will say, oh, well, protests put pressure on elected officials. But most elected officials nowadays will just wait it out. Because to your point, they know there's a cycle. There's a clock on this, and it's going to expire. It's going to dwindle. They already know this. So they just sit tight like cowards, and they wait us out. And so we just have to keep educating the public. Hey, listen, when you're here, you know, this is when we have the audience. We need to use the mic, not just to talk about how bad we hate police and how angry we are, but to educate the people that show up on what they need to do afterwards to focus on city council elected officials or to vote them out if they're not going to respond. But I think we have to escalate our response. We have to be more aggressive. I think we need to storm city council meetings and be like, hey, this, you know, we're not asking, you know, we're tired of people being killed and we don't want that in our community. So we want to take the proactive steps now to make sure that we improve our model and how we keep our citizens safe. If we don't do that, the people in power are just waiting us out. They don't care that we're protesting. It's frustrating, but I feel like that's the reality we're faced with.
And in your eyes or in your opinion, what something of police reform that you think has, or an example of police reform? You know, I know you hear defund the police, which,
sure.
But what could you kind of give an example of what that means, or in terms of police reform, what that is?
Yeah, so there's a long list of really specific detail that each community has to decide. These are the list that we're going to adopt from that long master list. And that's everything. It could be something major like, hey, you know, banning chokeholds, to something like, hey, stopping, you know, silent cops, saying, you know, hey, we're going to punish cops that witness this abuse and don't speak up, right? We're going to hold them accountable as well. Rules for that. But at a systemic level change, you have to move, you have to take the money away from here and put it into other response resources so that we're being proactive. And that's a major change. So there's little rules you can change. You can, you know, little rules you can enact to prevent harm to the citizens. And you can write rules of engagement and say, these are the instances where you're allowed to shoot. But ultimately, it's a major reallocation of those financial resources, reinvesting in proactive solutions. You know, if you invest in communities that are blighted and you can prevent crime, you're going to keep those neighborhoods and those people a lot safer rather than just waiting to call the cops after the crime has already occurred. It's a stupid system. So that requires systemic major change in how we, where we put our taxpayer dollars. If we focus on improving education and housing and creating opportunity and jobs and youth activities, whatever the community needs where that crime is happening, we've seen case studies where they do that, they put the money there and crime goes down. We should be preventing crime, not just reacting. Police show up, police aren't preventing crime, they show up after it's already happened. And so people like to use Chicago, it's murder, look at these communities, look at Southside Chicago, look at how bad it is. The cops aren't there to help, they're not reducing crime, right? You have to focus on the problems in the community and give them the resources they need so that those communities can be lifted up. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, when you respond, you have to do it in a way that's meaningful, that's targeted, and that is appropriate for the call that you get. If you have someone who's having a mental health issue, if you get a call about a homeless person, you should never send a person with a gun in those situations. It's not necessary. You should wait until there's a specific identified need. Okay, this person has a knife, we're here on site, we're not safe, there's an established confirmed harm. That's the only time you call the guy with a gun to show up and help you out. I'm not saying we don't need police, but those instances where we need somebody with a gun to show up are super, super rare. They're a tiny percentage of the majority of the calls that dispatchers get. And so we have to totally reimagine the model of how we police our communities. It's not always send a guy with a gun. That's a stupid, narrow-minded, ignorant model. It needs to be a much more highly nuanced model that says, okay, if we get this call, we're going to send a caseworker. If we get this call, we're going to send a mental health expert. If we get this call, we're going to send a social services specialist that specializes in a homeless response or whatever. There are so many ways that we can respond to peacefully keep people safe and respond to the specific need. I mean, I can go on and on because there's so many small examples, but we need it all. You know, we have instances where, you know, if your car breaks down on the highway or you've got a busted taillight or whatever, in most communities and in most states, the police will pull you over. And rather than helping the situation, they make it worse. If somebody has a taillight out or they have a headlight out, sometimes this person, you know, your license plate is expired or whatever. Sometimes it's a financial issue. The person driving that vehicle doesn't have the means. They've got more important things. I'm trying to feed my kids. I'm trying to pay my rent. I'm trying to keep the lights on so that my kids can, you know, keep the Wi-Fi going or whatever. They're trying to provide for their families. And so you've got, again, you know, this major, you know, economic systems that are working against these folks. So if you have a cop that pulls you over for a busted headlight and you know your headlight's out, you can tell when a headlight is out while you're driving at night. But you do it because you have to get to work and you know, whatever. Our current response is to give them a ticket. So I see you're financially struggling. Guess what? You owe more money now under the threat of freaking abduction. If you don't pay, judge is going to issue a bench warrant for you. We're going to take you away. Take you away from your family. Take you away from your job. Take you away from your kids. That's insane that people act like that's normal. That is not normal. Why would we respond to that situation that way? It is absolutely insane. And people have become so normalized to this broken model. But the right response is, and a few communities get it and a handful of states get it, the right response is a taxpayer-funded truck rolls up, change your bulb, and sends you on your way. That's the right response. We've seen it happen where, you know, you call the Department of Transportation and they have trucks that roll out on the highways and will jumpstart your car, or they have some basic parts for most common issues, because they want you to get back on the road, because they don't want you on the shoulder. They don't want an accident to occur, and they don't want to impede traffic. Their goal is to help the situation, to make it safer for everyone on that roadway. And that's the model that we should adopt in every municipality, in every community, in every state nationwide. Not this stupid, oh, we're going to punish people for being poor and make their situation worse. That is a stupid system, and we just have to be willing to turn off the part of our brain that says, okay, we understand what the status quo is. Like, pretend it's not there, shut it off, start blank. What would you think is the right answer in this situation? Forget what we do right now. If you just looked at the situation and said, what do you think is a good idea? You think it's a good idea for us to ticket that person and charge them money? That seems kind of silly, right? What could we do that would make that situation better? It's not that hard. We know the answers. But we have to force them. If the people in those city council seats aren't going to do it, they're just going to wait us out and ignore us. If they don't give a damn, you got to go in there and force them, or you got to vote them out and get people in there that will do the job.
And I know in terms of where there have been some changes in terms of not just sending cops when there's when 911 is called, I believe Denver, Colorado, they're now just sending social workers now instead of cops when there's a you know, obviously depends on the situation. If it's just, maybe it's a case of somebody is having, a mental health kind of thing, where it's a person having a mental health issue, and it's not a clear threat. I guess we'd assume, because it should be noted that people who are mentally ill are often the victims of
they are brutalized by police at a much higher rate than the normal citizen. It's disgusting, but folks with mental illnesses are often hurt the most by police because they're not able to comply like you and I can. And so if they have communication challenges, if they have challenges communicating like you and I do, if they have challenges with people invading their personal space, if they have challenges with understanding these ridiculous commands that are being barked at them and they're not processing things the way that you and I are, these folks are highly vulnerable, because the police are all about authoritarianism. I said, do this and you didn't, boom, I'm going to get my stick out and hit you. It's insane. We definitely don't want to send the guy with the gun or the stick or the taser out there to those situations. We need someone who understands this is a person with a mental illness, and we're going to need someone, a trained expert, a mental health expert or a social worker, someone who has experience dealing with these. You mentioned Denver. Yeah, I think they've had several hundred calls where they send a van out, and I think it's a combination of like a paramedic and a social worker type of tag team. I might have those wrong, but neither of them is an armed police officer. And so far, as of the last report we saw anyways, they've never had to escalate. They've never had to harm someone. They've never had to call the police in with the guns to respond. And hundreds of calls. And it's a small sample, right? But there's evidence. There's case studies there. We know that these experiences exist, and they have better models. And they're able to respond to the need without hurting the person, without killing them, without just showing up and saying, I'm going to tell you to do something. If you don't, I'm going to hurt you. That's a simple, stupid, stubborn, narrow-minded approach that is not safe. It doesn't keep anyone safe. In fact, I would argue it endangers police when they go in there with that type of authoritarian behavior, because these people are frustrated. And some of these folks, they have the potential, the citizen, the civilian, suffering from a mental breakdown, suffering from depression. They could want to hurt themselves or others. And when you go in the way police do, they push them. They hit those buttons, those triggers that could lead to it. I'm like, you're really endangering not just that person. Of course, we know they do that. But, I mean, you're endangering yourself when you go in so stubbornly and stupid and behave that way and with these individuals when you mishandle a situation. So it's totally counterproductive to their narrative that they're doing it because they have to protect themselves. Well, you're creating danger for yourself by escalating the situation. You had somebody who was upset, and now you have escalated. Now they're grabbing a kitchen knife, and now you're going to kill them. But you did that. You forced them to go get that knife because you didn't have a damn clue what you were doing, and you just decided to escalate the situation. They're not trained mental health experts. I'm not suggesting that they should be. I'm suggesting those aren't calls they should be handling, period. You don't need a guy with a gun for that.
Unfortunately, to bring it back to Breonna Taylor, and I believe she was with her, the police came. They got the wrong address on a thing. I think it was like a sting case, but they got the wrong address. Her partner, Kenneth Walker, I guess they were trying to bang the door down. They were trying to, and I guess he shot at them because he thought their home was being broken into.
Of course.
And they shot back at him. And investigation, the FBI showed that the officers it was the officers that killed Breonna Taylor. And it was the way it was just such horror. It was just such a horror because I believe even after they got him arrested, she was still alive. I believe they were showing symptoms of alive. And unfortunately, they did not act in time. They waited way, way too long for any kind of medical attention. So it was just such a, I mean, that's what makes this, obviously what makes, you know, the fact that nobody mm-hmm. was prosecuted, nobody was found, nobody, right. there essentially was justice, if you could essentially call it justice. I mean, unfortunately, mm-hmm. But yes, it was just so poorly, it was just one problem, one just poorly just worked by the police, the Louisville police.
Yeah, and we've seen this in other police departments as well. They will harm someone and then just leave them there. They don't want to render first aid. They don't want to prioritize a medical response to try some life-saving response. They just presume, okay, well, we know we killed them. We're okay if they die. And they don't even attempt to perform any sort of, you know, life-saving response. No first aid rendered, nothing. They take their sweet time. We've seen videos. It happened in the case of George Floyd. It happened in the case of Breonna Taylor. And we've seen other videos where, let's talk about George Floyd, where the guy, if you hear the audio tape that was released later, after the original video, you hear the officer turn to the other officer after George Floyd has been murdered and is no longer responding and is no longer breathing. You hear the bystanders saying, check his pulse, I think he's dead, he's not breathing anymore. He's gone, I think you killed him, right? So we at this point we know George Floyd is dead, but you hear these officers turn to each other and one of them asks, they're not concerned about George Floyd, he asks the officer, are you okay? That's disgusting. Like, in what world do you kill someone and you're looking around and your concern is, how's your leg? How's your arm? Is your knee okay? Did you scrape yourself? Are you okay? There's a guy on the ground, dead, dying. His last breaths are gasping for air have left or are leaving his body. And you have zero regard for that black man's life. None whatsoever. That's tough to swallow. But we see that response from cops over and over. They do not treat that civilian as an equal citizen. They don't treat them as innocent until proven guilty. They murder them like a dog in the street, and they don't even recognize, they dehumanize them. They don't even recognize that that's a human life that they're dealing with.
I unfortunately am going to have to stop the interview as we are running out of time. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And that'll be it for this program of Where We Are At here on 90.1 FM Radio, WEFT. Please stay tuned for more programming. I will be back here with another show next week. I'm going to play a little tune called South Street Strut by the Great North Sound Society. Thank you very much, and have a good night.
I'm Bob Selby, speaking to you from my home in Champaign.